a call to order the General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection Committee. Today is January 19th, 2012, and we are convened for the purposes of an informational hearing. We will probably do the work sessions first on the committee bills that we will be introducing, and then move to the top of the agenda with the informational meeting regarding retirement security, and then to home ownership stabilization initiative after that. So I just got word that Senator George may need to leave in a hurry. He's got a little one on the way, and who knows if he might need to leave.
Sure, I'd like to correct. His wife has a little one on the way.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, thank you. Yes, that is very well put. So why don't I just go ahead and open a work session on LC 71. Jan, you teed up for us?
LC 71, we're looking at the one dated January 17, 2012. This was a drafting request made by Alan Tressiter on behalf of the Oregon Interior Design Collaborative. And the measure establishes a Board of Commercial Interior Design, and it requires persons practicing interior design to be registered with the board, allows the board to establish fees for application, registration, renewal, and examination, and allows the board to impose civil penalties, declares an emergency effective on passage.
I'll be giving some other proponents the opportunity to explain their bill a little bit further. Was anybody here regarding LC 71 that would like to say anything?
I don't have anything.
You're okay? Okay. Should we do them individually or in block?
That'd be fine.
Okay.
You don't expect any
notice? Okay. I don't think so. So then I should just open a work session on the next one.
We're not going to do them in block?
Do you want my motion for everything right now?
You can stay in the work session. We'll just do
them all in block.
Okay.
That way you only have to give one disclaimer. I only have to give one disclaimer.
All right, Jan, could you tee up LC 137 for us, please?
LC 137, dated January 18, 2012, is a drafting request made by Doug Riggs representing the Oregon Primary Care Association. And the measure requires the Oregon Health Authority to take into account psychological and social factors facing members of coordinated care organizations, those are the CCOs, when establishing quality measures and global budgets. And it requires an advisory committee to the Oregon Health Authority in the rulemaking process to include membership to represent community providers who serve recipients of medical assistance. Declares an emergency effective on passage.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Doug Riggs with the Oregon Primary Care Association. I'll be very brief and let Jennifer explain the bill a little bit. I do want to say that this concept has been developing over a number of years. We've spoken with the Senate and the House Health Care Committees about these concepts off and on, and we spoke at length with the panel in December, and that's where Senator Shields and I had a conversation. So really appreciate the committee introducing this. I will say I think it's going to be broadly supported. I've had conversations with the mental health, behavioral health, and alcohol and dependency communities, so I think we're going to see broad support for this concept as it moves through the process.
Good morning, Jennifer Pratt, Deputy Director of the Oregon Primary Care Association. Again, I'd like to add my thanks along with Doug's for carrying this forward for us. This bill, just in brief, is we feel is very critical in as a component of the CCO or complement to the CCO process that's moving forward, because many, many people, particularly those in the Medicaid population, suffer from barriers to good health, from making good health choices because of psychological and social factors in their life, such as homelessness, substance abuse, as Doug was referencing. And we feel that if this aspect of their life is not taken into consideration as the CCOs are formed and their payment structures are created, the cost to the system is going to be significant. The cost to the people is going to be significant. The outcomes are not going to be produced as is envisioned by the triple aim. And the providers who serve this population, these are some of the ones that are called the high flyers, the most expensive, most difficult patients to manage. And those providers are also going to suffer. And some of them will, if they end up being the ones who end up with the majority of them because others don't, may suffer significantly and have to change their practice if not close their doors. So that's it in brief, and I'd be glad to answer any questions, but again, appreciate you very much taking this forward.
Yeah, I'm glad we did introduce this. It's turning out in the Tri-County area there are some real problems with how the CCO is developing, and I'm glad this bill will be in the pipeline as well. Is there any other discussion? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jan, could you tee up LC 237, mm-hmm. please?
LC 237, dated January 18, 2012. Their drafting request was made by Rose Cox on behalf of the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Center Association. And the measure requires insurers to reimburse providers directly if the provider agrees that the payment is considered payment in full for service, excluding amounts that the patient is responsible for. If the service provider does not agree, then the insurer may make payment to the patient or the provider.
Ms. Cox.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, thank you so much for introducing this bill. Very briefly, this is an issue that we spoke about some last year and visited with y'all on. Just to give you, the bill is pretty self-explanatory, just states that even if there is not a contract, whether there's a contract or not, between an insurer and a provider, that if the provider agrees not to do what's called balance billing, which is to go to the patient and try and collect additional money above and beyond what the insurer allows as allowable charges, to include copayment, coinsurance, and deductibles, that the insurer must send the payment to the provider. What's happening currently is that some payments are being sent directly to the patients. Those patients are either through a lack of understanding or malicious intent pocketing the money that should go to the provider for services that have already been rendered. This is not a good situation for insurers or for providers, because everyone believes that you should be paid for work that you've done. We are currently having discussions with the insurers. The Ambulatory Surgery Center and Regents had sat down once. We've also sat down with AHIP and LifeWise, Elise Brown. I will say very specifically that the insurance lobby is against this bill in its current form. Shocking, right? But we are having some good discussions. We are trying to figure out ways to address the issue either through legislation or ideally not through legislation. But if we're working on language together, and I want to assure you that the Ambulatory Surgery Center will not be coming to you with a request to try and settle our argument for us, that we are working on language that we can all come together on, and only in that case will we come to you for this bill to actually be run. Do you have any questions?
No, thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. All right, we're ready for a motion. Senator George?
And we're not going to do anything with LC 135, correct?
No.
Okay. I'm taking that off. Mr. Chair, I move that LC 71, LC 137, and LC 237 be accepted as committee bills.
Senator George has moved LC 71, 137, and 237 be accepted as committee bills. Is there any discussion?
You want to make your boilerplate statement?
Yes. Yeah. To put
you,
on
Mr.
the record, you are not implying that you support these bills, but that you are just allowing them as a courtesy to the chair to be brought into the process. We will have a full vote on these bills later if they happen to come back to this committee. And I also want to put on the record that relating to LC 237 and LC 137, that in an abundance of caution, I want to put on the record that I have a potential conflict in that my wife is a primary care provider. Further discussion? Senator Dinkfelder, welcome to the committee.
Yeah, driving was a nightmare this morning, so apologize.
No problem.
I was one of the slow people in the right lane, and everyone was cursing.
Sure.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not necessarily opposed to any of them, in favor of a couple of them. In an abundance of caution, I'm mad at the insurance companies this morning, so just for the record. And I'm not necessarily opposed, but open to discussion on any of them.
Okay. So we have a motion before us to accept LC 71, LC 137, and LC 237 as committee bills. Welcome, Senator Rosenbaum. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, these are now committee bills and accepted into the process. We will close the work session on LC 71, LC 137, and LC 237, and I will open an informational meeting on retirement security and public and private sectors. Anything that you want to say, Ms. Committee Administrator? Okay, good. Well, I think rather than trying to tee this up myself, we'll just bring up the first panel. Could we bring up Jessica Stevens, Ellen Schultz, and Doug Hall, if that's how you would like to proceed? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning. Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, and members of the committee, my name is Jessica Stevens, and I'm testifying today on behalf of SEIU Local 503. We're here today to discuss an issue that affects all Oregonians but is often overlooked. While public debate around retirement often focuses on pensions for state and local government employees, reality is there is a crisis for many workers in the public and private sectors, union and non-union. Our members have long advocated to protect public employee retirement benefits, but we've begun a new conversation with our members, the clients we serve, and senior advocacy partners about the financial challenges of retirement in Oregon. SEIU Local 503 represents over 50,000 members who provide critical services, but over half of our members do not have retirement benefits through their current employers. This fact is particularly pronounced with our home care providers, who both experience and with their clients witness the challenge of being a low-income retiree without retirement benefits. We are also in discussions with private sector employees and retirees who worry about making ends meet during retirement age. The private pension system is fraying with fewer workers covered by pension plans. And although workers' ability to achieve retirement security has long been premised on a system of mutual responsibility, government-provided Social Security, employer-provided pensions, and personal savings, only Social Security now guarantees a universal benefit. We believe that retirement security, and while all of this is happening, Oregonians have also been losing ground in their retirement benefits. The public funding that provides services to Oregon's most vulnerable seniors continues to decline. We believe that retirement security is fast becoming a goal beyond the reach of most Oregonians. Seniors can no longer rely on the services they need to get through the tough times and usually have little to fall back on. SEIU members are working to bring this discussion into the forefront. We believe that the best way to examine this challenge is to hear from experts in the area of retirement security. So today we will be joined first by Doug Hall. Doug is the director of the Economic Policy Institute and the Economic Analysis and Research Network of the Economic Policy Institute. Doug will walk us through a study conducted by EPI on the state of retirement in Oregon. Next, we will hear from Ellen Schultz. Ellen is a former investigative reporter who has won numerous awards, including the 2001 Sidney Hillman Foundation Award for a series of articles on how companies profit from their retirement benefit plans. Ellen is also the author of the book Retirement Heist. Following Ellen, we will hear from Daniel Rodriguez with AARP Oregon. And last, we will hear from Kit Good, an SEIU Local 503 home care provider. Through these speakers, we hope to encourage discussion on retirement insecurity in our state, and we look forward to partnering with legislators and other advocates on this emerging challenge. Thank you.
All right, good morning. Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, and members of the committee, thank you so much for braving the elements to join us here today. Jessica did a great job of outlining, the real purpose of this study is informational. We're trying to move ourselves and you and other folks in Oregon up the learning curve to get a better sense of what the current status is of retirees and what the future prospects are. It's my sense that, as Jessica outlined, retirement security is in a very challenging situation right now, in the sense that I don't think we're at a crisis point, but I think we are at a point where, as the baby boomers are moving into their retirement years, we have a system in place that as some of these data points will illustrate, isn't serving the whole population to the extent that it needs to. The good news is that we have time to be thoughtful and deliberate and make sure that we pursue public policies that help to put folks on a more solid retirement grounds. All right. So Oregon, I don't think, is unique in this sense. I mean, most of the retirement issues that Oregon is struggling with are ones that are also being challenging folks nationally. Overall, Oregonians rely quite heavily on Social Security, particularly lower-income retirees. Retirement funds, most of which are employer-based, account for a relatively small share of income amongst retirees, again, especially among lower-income retirees. Lower-income retirees are disproportionately women, so this is very much an issue of gender. And among current workers, employer-provided retirement plans cover less than half of all workers. I think it's 47% and change. And those rates are much lower, as you'll see, for workers in smaller firms and for lower-income workers. So the first graph I want to show you, and you, I believe you all have the slides as well as the study that these slides are based on?
No.
No? All right, well, that was my impression.
It's in the briefing paper?
Yeah.
Yeah, we have that.
But the slide, they don't have the slides? All right, that's fine. You don't need the slides. The slides are
right. It's on the drive?
It's on the S drive.
Okay.
S drive, if you brought your
computer. All right, so I will speak to the slides. So this is what the overall population looks like in Oregon. These are the sources of retirement income. And you see very clearly there, Social Security accounts for darn close to half of income for retirees overall. Retirement funds, on this slide, it actually looks pretty solid. If there's supposed to be three or four legs to retirement security stool, those being Social Security, personal savings, employer-based retirement funds, and then the fourth one that our friends from AARP introduced me to yesterday is healthcare. You know, that leg of the stool, the retirement funds leg, seems to be doing a pretty good job there. But what you see as we drill down a little deeper is that there's significant variations in terms of the sources of income that vary by income source. So we'll show you the chart first, and then we'll show you the graph. And so there's a couple of things here that I think are really noteworthy. First of all, you'll see that amongst the bottom 25% of income earners, amongst retirees, 85% of their income comes from Social Security. Mm-hmm. Retirement funds account for a paltry 2.2% of their income in their retirement years. That's $152 a year. That's just a little over $10 a month from retirement funds. Clearly, there's a system there that's not working for folks in the lower quartile of retirees in Oregon. As you move up the income spectrum, you see that the share that is reliant on Social Security starts to get smaller, and the share that retirement funds accounts for gets larger. And then in the top 25%, you'll see that at that level, retirement funds actually account for the largest piece of the pie, accounting for over $21,000 a year. I ran the numbers on that earlier, and you know it's like more than 100, you know it's like 142 times greater or something like that than the $152 that folks are getting from retirement funds. What does that look like in pictures? Here we see again.
Could you excuse me, real quickly, Senator Boquist?
Yes, could I ask you a question? I think I know the answer, but I guess I should put it on the rest. As you're explaining this, when you're talking about Social Security, we're talking about federal Social Security.
That's
which,
correct.
Which the Congress has raided most of it, and we're borrowing 40 cents on the dollar to finance the budget. And the second thing is when you talk about retirement funds, are we really primarily talking about market funds, which kind of like playing roulette these days? So besides the volatility, you're saying they have their own volatilities inside of them?
Some of them do, yes. I mean, the retirement security category, the most significant chunk of that is some sort of employer-based savings plan. Now, as most of you know, we've seen a shift from defined benefits to defined contributions as people have shifted away from, you know, towards plans like 401ks. So the volatility is certainly in the mix there's no question about that. And certainly for folks you know, at the higher end, that's where a larger chunk of their resources are, so that they would probably be watching that much more closely. If you've got 2.2% of your income coming, there's not a whole lot that volatility can do to hurt you. You're already feeling the pain no matter what.
Yeah, all of us are. Thank you.
So there's a couple of things about this. I mean, the stark differences across incomes, I think, is mm-hmm. clearly noteworthy, and I won't belabor it too much. I will note, though, that none of these three pie charts resembles the overall that I showed you first. And I think that's really important because it sends a message that if you're just looking at the statewide averages, and this is true at, you know, whatever level of data you're looking at, there's a story behind that story. It's like an onion. You got to peel back the layers to really understand what's going on. So I think that's really important and instructive. So to get a sense of who are Oregon retirees, here we take a look by race and gender and across the income spectrum. And there's a couple of things here that I think are noteworthy. Representation of white workers goes up. As you move up the income spectrum, black and Hispanic workers moves down. And the stark difference in the distribution of men and women across income categories, I think, is really noteworthy as well. You see that amongst the bottom 25% of Oregon retirees, 4/5 of them are women. By the time you get to the top 25th, you're just a little over a third that are women. And so, as one would expect, these variances in income based on retirement income result in variances in where people fall with respect to the federal poverty level. And certainly, the differences by gender here are stark as well. Women are more likely to be living in extreme poverty. They're more likely to be living in poverty. And they're more likely to be living in that zone, you know, between 100 and 200% of poverty. On the other hand, you'll see that retirees, they are to a certain extent kept out of poverty, and that's in large part because of programs at work like Social Security. But at the same time, they make up a higher share, and you'll see this more in the following pie charts, a higher share of folks at 200% or lower. So here again, we see this. Now, the other noteworthy thing, of course, is that while it's true that retirement income keeps people out of poverty fairly well, you're not seeing too many retirees. You're seeing a much smaller share of retirees in this 400% or more for the federal poverty level category. To get a sense of what it looks like by gender, again, you see those differences where women are more likely to be poor or near poor. And so what does the picture look like for current workers in Oregon? So the question we're looking at here is, to what extent are employers offering employer-based retirement plans to their workers? Overall, you see that in terms of the participation rate, which is a combination of having access to it and workers taking that up, you see that just a little under half of all workers, 47.7%, have retirement savings plans at their place of employment. And again, you see huge variances here as you move up the income spectrum. It's pretty dramatic. The other very important thing to note is that it varies considerably by firm size. So right across the board, the larger the firm you work for, the more likely you are to have access to retirement savings.
Good question, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
The firm size, 1 to 24 employees, are we talking about all access, 29%? So what we're really talking about on that line is only 30% of firms, 1 to 24 employees, offer a plan. And of that, only 30% of their employees participate in the plan.
That's right. Okay. Yeah. And
can you, since those are all small businesses, do you have a little background information on that in terms of, is it the management of the plan? Is it they just don't offer a plan? Is it too hard for a small business to set up a plan?
My sense is that there's very much economies of scale to setting up systems like that. And so having something available to small business where they could, you know, have pooled access to some retirement plans would be an excellent option, I would think.
Follow-up question, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
I know some fall, I mean, for an example, I mean, years ago we had a retirement plan in one of our companies, and the problem was it cost more to manage the retirement plan than it did for people to put money in, and we were putting more money into it. We had to spend more money to manage the bloody thing, and so we went back to encouraging people, you know, to do an IRA, or we make a contribution or a bonus to go to an IRA. Mm-hmm. Is this actually this 29.6% actually a formal plan, or are there some variations to it?
I would say it's probably a formal plan. I mean, all of these data are survey-based data, and so, you know, there's a fairly rigidly defined categories,
right.
But
I understand. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions?
Just since we've stopped, could you just clarify the difference between take-up and participation here?
Well, so take-up is the percentage of workers who opt into the accessible plan. And so if you crunch the numbers, you'll see, for example, that access times take-up in the all category is like 6 times 8 is 48. So participation is the overall sort of how
the of the entire pool, including all these people who don't have retirement plans at all.
Yeah.
Got it. Thanks.
I got one question. Actually, Doug, one of the things I was noticing is you're talking about income. Does your chart adjust for actual net worth?
75%.
One of the things is like, I've been reading some statistics about how many people have $1 million over $1 million in assets, but are in CDs at 1%. So what's happening is they're getting $10,000 a year of income off of $1 million of assets. So is any of this adjusted for what the net worth of these folks are?
This is just income. Yeah.
Okay.
Now I would say that anyone who has $1 million worth of assets that's only making $10,000 a year, at some point they should have had a conversation with their broker.
You'd be shocked, actually. I mean, you'd actually be shocked. A lot of older people really trust CDs, and they put their money in CDs for a security purpose. And so there's a lot of working class folks who have amassed, through different reasons, quite a bit of capital. And the question really is how do you, a lot of them, especially those who came through the Depression, don't want to go into their principal, so they'll live on a very meager income for security purposes. And so I was just wondering if there's any way to sort of vet out the net worth of these individuals.
No, and it becomes especially difficult when you're dealing with data sets that have statistical limitations. You may have noticed in these slides that we're looking at a 10-year span, basically, and we had to do that in order to get large enough sample sizes to tease out data by gender, by race, et cetera. So if you were to try to cut it another way by, you know, assets, you would quickly lose any statistical relevance you had. And I don't think we can do that with the current population survey data that this is based on anyway. But your question is instructive. On the one hand, yes, there are people who have wealth, but the real story here is how are people meeting their basic needs? And, you know, if you happen to have $1 million, you know, you and I both know that depleting that resource, you know, could happen fairly quickly, and if people are retiring, you know, at a reasonable age, they may have, you know, 25, 30 years. That strategy is not going to work for long. They need to have capital that they can draw on that provides them with an adequate income to support themselves. And so it's important even for those folks that we have systems in place that do well by them.
Thank you. You can go ahead.
Yeah, and actually, I mean, we talked about these last two slides. Again, it's pretty stark. You see the contrast between the folks at the bottom and the folks at the top in terms of their access to plans and their participation rates, and again by firm size. So, when you put it all together, you know, it's a really compelling story to suggest that there are populations, particularly women, particularly lower-income folks, whose needs are not adequately being met by the systems that we have in place right now. The good news, as I said, is that we can take a look at shaping policies and behaviors of individuals, of firms, to ensure a greater degree of financial security for what will be, you know, the most significant retiring demographic in history. So.
Thank you. Any questions? All right, Ellen, I think you're up next.
Senator, thank you. My name's Ellen Schultz. And I was an investigative reporter with the Wall Street Journal there 21 years, and covering primarily retirement industry. And I do call it an industry because it is sort of a coalition of employers, financial service firms, insurers, and this coalition works together to help employers find profit or make their retirement plans work in ways that are profitable to the companies rather than focusing primarily on their benefit to the participants in the plan. I found that if you look at what employers have been complaining about and what the general impression in the public is of the private sector pension system, we all hear it's in a crisis. We hear that companies are freezing plans. The companies all say they can't afford to offer these plans anymore. They blame the stock market, which, of course, has contributed greatly to the loss of assets. They blame low interest rates. They complain about the aging workforce and say that's had a terrible effect on them. But if you look under the hood and you look into the filings, you'll see a very different story. If you look at the retirement system the way a businessman or investor would, you would see that the scenario laid out by employers is not accurate. As recently as 2007, pension plans in the private sector, which cover 44 million people, mind you, they have not vanished, these plans were fully funded collectively. That was 2007. And if you go back just 7 years earlier than that, the private sector pension system had $250 billion in surplus assets. So that was enough money to cover everyone in the plan, current and future, regardless of how long they lived. It didn't matter what longevity, there was no longevity effect. But so what happened? One of the things that happened is that employers have found numerous ways to remove money from pension plans for things other than pensions. Throughout the 90s and into the 2000s, employers have withdrawn billions of dollars from their plans to finance restructuring. Now, you're aware of the waves of layoffs of the hundreds of thousands of older workers, especially in telecom and defense and industries that were changing rapidly, and you wanted to get rid of 100,000 employees. One way was to offer them additional money from the pension plan in lieu of severance, and this saved companies cash. You know, instead of paying cash out of the coffers, you just give them extra pension money. So that took, you know, billions out of the plan. As recently, even in 2008, Ford Motor used $2.4 billion from its pension plan in lieu of severance to people. Companies also use the assets to pay for retiree health benefits, which were, they're essentially a medical pension. They continue your health coverage to age 65. And by doing that, you know, DuPont and other companies, using the cash from the pension plan to pay retiree health benefited the companies, though at the expense of the pension plan. Other things that depleted the assets in the plans were mergers and acquisition deals. Companies had a number of ways to monetize the assets in the plan. A common way would be, say, for a defense contractor to sell a unit, transfer, of course, the pension and the people in the unit, but send over additional pension. Let's say it's $100 million additional. What would they get for that? Well, the buyer would give them more money for the sale. He might give them an additional $80 million to purchase the unit. So what the buyer is getting is an asset worth $100 million, pays $80 million. What the seller gets is $80 million. So you can see that there was this enormous temptation to move pension assets around through sales in order to convert them into cash. Now, other things that depleted the assets were the ability of companies to use loopholes in discrimination rules to actually use pension assets to cover executive pensions and executive deferred compensation. Now, there are ways to do this that don't hurt the pension plan, but there are a number of examples of companies that moved so much of the pension asset into the executive pension pot on paper that it caused the plans to weaken. And flatware maker Oneida, you've heard of them if you have flatware in your home. As they were struggling and going into bankruptcy, they had earmarked money in the regular pension plan to pay for executives. And companies aren't supposed to exactly do this under tax rules. So they'll attach a list saying CFO will get an additional $50,000 a month from the pension plan. So that was one strategy. Another thing that was happening was that companies were terminating healthy pension plans. You know, we have this notion that pensions were terribly burdensome and companies couldn't afford them, so they had to get rid of them and put in a 401k. But in many cases, the pension plan was healthy, but the companies had an incentive to kill the plan to take the surplus. Now, if you remember your history back to the 80s, corporate raiders, Hurwitzes and Perlmans, would take over companies that had overfunded pension plans. Maybe you've heard of Pacific Lumber, you know, just a little south of here. If it had a huge surplus, the raiders would take over the company, terminate the plan, of course, pay out the annuities, and they would keep the excess for themselves. Now, Congress stepped in and stopped that. It said, you can't do that. We're going to put an excise tax. So that took away the benefit of doing that. However, there's a loophole, and the loophole is this. If you set up a 401k, for example, and take 25% of that surplus, and you're going to use that to make contributions, then you can keep the rest of the surplus and pay only a 20% tax. And that's something Montgomery Ward did with its very healthy overfunded pension plan. So it killed the plan, kept the money. Of course, it still went into bankruptcy, and the creditors ended up getting the money that would have gone into the 401k. So we had those waves of termination. The other, which we've seen more commonly recently, have been companies that have failed to fund their pension plans. So they're keeping the cash instead of putting it into a plan. And this, you know, this causes the plan to become underfunded. And in bankruptcy, the company then goes to the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corp, which is the employer-financed insurance program, and says, we cannot emerge from bankruptcy unless you allow us to dump this pension plan. And we saw this happen with U.S. Airways, where it had a number of pensions. It had one for the machinists, flight attendants, and pilots. Pilots was the most costly plan, and in bankruptcy court, they were allowed to dump that plan. And the effect on the pilots, of course, was significant. They lost a large percentage of their pensions. We've seen this happen, and this has been in the press recently, private equity firms taking over companies and, you know, selling off assets and not funding the pension. And that if they go into bankruptcy, they end up turning the plan over to the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corp, and people lose a significant amount of money. Now, the private equity, if you went through a mall around here, you'd probably half the stores you'd see or chains would be private equity firms, like Burger King, Burlington Coat Factory, Domino's Pizza, Dunkin' Donuts. Recently Hostess. Also private equity. Now, the problem that we've seen with those, like with Reader's Digest, Hostess, Samsonite, Simmons, and your own local Harry and David, is that when they go into bankruptcy, the private equity firms, again, are able to take that liability, shift it away to somebody else, emerge from bankruptcy if they do, and without that obligation, it's been removed. And, of course, this enriches the creditors and the shareholders and the executives, but it does, of course, harm the pensions of everyone else. Yet another way that assets left pension plans is that employers are allowed to use the assets to pay the consultants and the lawyers that help them devise these techniques and to fight lawsuits when people challenge them. Something I wrote about was the NFL, which used millions of dollars to pay its law firms to fight lawsuits brought by football players who were fighting to get a football disability pension, unsuccessfully, usually. So that's where a lot of assets went. Now, one way that companies began to try and replete, you take money out, this is a piggy bank, one way you can make it healthy is by cutting benefits. And this was going on in the 90s, even when companies had billions of dollars in surplus, and we're talking about $24 billion at Verizon and its predecessors. AT&T and GE each had $20 billion in surplus. IBM had $7 billion. Companies began to cut their pensions because if you cut the pensions, you don't have to pay the money out, and you have more in the piggy bank that you can use. But there was another, actually more profound reason that you would cut pensions even if you had plenty of money to pay them, and that is the accounting rules that changed in the early 90s. The accounting rules said you have to record your retiree liabilities as a debt, like a pension or retiree health care. So if you've got that debt on your books, what happens if you cut benefits and you reduce the liability by $1 billion, well, two good things for you happen. You get to, in future, not pay out $1 billion, so that's more money in your plan, but you get something else that's more important. You get to report $1 billion in income. Now, it's one thing to have $1 billion sitting on the table. That doesn't help your earnings. But if that $1 billion in your plan is there because you have reduced benefits, you get to report that as profit. So taking you back in time, Boeing's predecessor, McDonnell Douglas, when it adopted these rules, it cut its retiree health benefits and eliminated them. That gave it more than $1 billion in income in the first year. It was the only income the company had. So throughout the 90s into the 2000s, any kind of retiree benefit, whether it's dental, health care, pension, workers' comp, if a company can trim it, they can report those savings as income and pushes up stock price, pushes up earnings. Now, this, unfortunately, for employees and retirees, coincided with a change in executive compensation practices. Instead of compensating executives primarily with salary, they began to say, all right, it's going to be performance-based, and this was for tax reasons. So you had a time when companies are awarding executives stock options, stock awards, or a bonus that's contingent on hitting an earnings target. So this coincided with the ability to cut retiree benefits to generate profit. So there was a massive and continuing shift in the liability structure at companies so that the liabilities for regular pensions are like frozen or falling. The liabilities for executives, which also include deferred compensation and SERPs, i.e. supplemental executive retirement plans, these have grown into the billions of dollars. At some companies, like GE, it's more than $5 billion. Any number of the largest companies, it's always well over $1 billion owed to their executives. And you can't see it usually because it's aggregated with the regular pensions. And I found that many companies complained about their expensive pensions. It was actually the executive pensions that were hurting their earnings. So it's the regular ones are getting scapegoated. The executive ones are causing the trouble. And it did create a dynamic. And I'm not saying executives set out to destroy the retirement benefits to, you know, enrich themselves, but that was in effect. There was this wealth transfer effect. So with that going on, the other thing to keep in mind is that the executives who were working with the consultants also kept a lot of these practices under the hood. These were not obvious. So when they were cutting pensions in the 90s, they weren't telling people, hey, we're cutting your pensions. They said, we're actually going to give you a new pension plan. It's better. It's better for a mobile workforce. It looks like a 401k. It's called a cash balance plan. And the whole problem with that, though, is when you made that conversion, what it was doing was it was reducing the pensions of older long service workers by 20 to 50%. And you might ask, how could somebody possibly have their pension cut by that much and not know it? Well, it's because the structures are complicated, and also because companies deliberately, in many cases, went out of the way to not tell people. Cigna, for example, deliberately deceived its employees, a federal court found. If you look at the memos, they're saying, here are our strategies to not tell them that their pensions are being cut because we don't want a backlash. So you have this element of misleading the public and misleading shareholders who very often thought that a lot of these profits were from great management when the profits were coming from the pension plan. And another thing that has occurred and still occurring that surprises people is that to help soften the blow of all this executive liability that's growing, the sort of legacy executive liability, companies not only are using the regular plans to find ways to pay them, but they are and have been taking out billions of dollars of life insurance on their employees. And you may have heard of this practice back in the 90s when it was primarily a tax dodge, but it has morphed into an executive finance scheme. And I use the word scheme to suggest nefarious. It's more like the British term. It meant that if you take out $1 billion of life insurance on your workers, you can use that pool of assets as an informal pension fund. And for accounting purposes, it really helps. It acts like a pension fund. Of course, when the employees die, you get the death benefit tax-free. So there are, you know, companies, you know, Disney, Nestle, Walmart, the big banks, they own billions of dollars still in life insurance on the employees, ex-employees, retirees, And of course, they can easily find out when people die by just checking the Social Security Death Index every month, which is what they do to collect the benefits. A recent case was Amegy Bank, where they had a credit risk analyst who, at the age of 40 or so, developed a brain tumor and was unable to do his job. So they fired him. Well, after he died, his widow accidentally received a check for more than $1 million in the mail. It was erroneously sent to her by the insurer. It should have gone to Amegy Bank, and she was surprised to see that Amegy Bank was getting more than $1 million for her husband's death, and she and her children got nothing because his life insurance had been canceled when he died. So this process actually has accelerated in the mortgage crisis. Looking at bank call reports, the large banks were taking out billions. J.P. Morgan Chase, I think, had the most. It owned about $11 billion in life insurance, which means they owe $11 billion to their executives, because there's a correlation between those things. Now, with all this going on, so many ways to profit from pensions and retiree health care, I'll give you one example of an extreme, the way this can look on the absolute extreme. It'll take Massey Energy Company, which you've heard of because of the Big Branch mining disaster, 2010, 29 miners died. Looking in their filings, let's see what happened at the end of the year. Blankenship, the CEO, left, and he received a package that was worth more than $50 million. And I looked at what the company also paid out that year to its thousands of retired miners. And we're talking for pensions, for their health care, for their traumatic workers' compensation, which covers crushed limbs and missing fingers and things like that, and their black lung benefits. You take all the amounts paid out for all of that, for all the miners, it was $37 million. So you got $37 million on one hand, you got $50 for one fellow on the other. And that shows you the sort of logical end of this process. Now you may ask about 401ks. Aren't they, you know, the great thing that's going to save this? And in looking at this whole process, no, 401ks are not, they have not been effective. People don't save. They can't save. They take the money out if they do save. When they change jobs, they end up spending the money, you know, pay for health care, housing, whatever. And there are even other pressures behind the scenes on 401ks that make them a risky bet for people. And that includes, of course, companies loading them up with their own stock because it's, you know, beneficial to the company to do that. And you saw, of course, in your home territory here, Enron, what happened when Enron went into bankruptcy and people lost huge amounts in their 401ks. You know, Enron had a cash balance plan, so people were sort of hit at every stage of the game by almost every technique a company could use to profit from its plans at the expense, though not deliberately, perhaps, of their employees and retirees. I talked to one fellow who works for Portland General Electric, and I first checked in with him in 2001 after Enron went bankrupt. And he was hurting then because his pension had already been cut, and his savings was, you know, down. He lost 50% at least, I think, of his 401k. So checked in with him over the years. His 401k recovered. His pension was what it was. And, of course, when the markets cratered in 2008, well, the pension plans out there had no more cushion anymore. They had spent it all. So when the markets went down, no cushion, well, the plans get frozen very often. And he lost another, you know, 40% of his 401k after all his efforts to sort of build it back up again. So he's not unusual. I did do a quantitative analysis of the Labor Department filings and found that people in many companies lost 40%. And, of course, the same dynamic wasn't at work on the executive side because a quarter of companies still provide guaranteed returns for their executives. So they had positive returns. With that, I invite you to invite any questions that you might have.
Representative, I mean, Senator Boquist, and then Senator George.
There's a lot of people at Ruth Sarah's representative. Alan, a couple of questions. I guess the first one is if you drilled down at all in Oregon, I mean, for example, and you raised the issue of defense contractors, and that's an area I'm familiar with.
they're going to have to take a 25% whack out of the federal budget, or else this country is going to go tank, because we're borrowing 40 cents on the dollar every day. But what's the status? Because we have some fairly substantial ones that most people don't know about, like Freightliner and others that are sitting in the state. You done any research on them in terms of how solvent their pension plans are?
Yes, they're sort of in the same middle of the pack with everyone else. Generally, plans collectively in this country are underfunded by roughly 20%. But that is not a figure to be frightened of, because we are, as you know, at the bottom of the interest rate cycle. I mean, even I couldn't believe they had gone that low. When interest rates rise, the liability will automatically improve. And many companies have frozen their plans or cut benefits, so the liability is not going to grow. When you reduce your workforce, your liability falls. It's a myth to think that, oh, well, the more retirees you have, the more people who aren't actually actively working, that your liabilities go up. They don't. They fall steadily, because people, once their pensions are paid out, that liability is zero if it's a lump sum, or it falls steadily every year with each payment. So the fact that you will have big layoffs, or you might have more people moving into retirement early to just say, you know, heck with this, that actually helps the company. So it doesn't hurt the pension funding. Keep in mind also that defense contractors, like, you know, utilities and others, when they have contracts with the government, you build in cost of the pensions and retiree health care into your labor contracts. So properly managed, if a defense firm has handled its retirement plans properly, then they were fully funded. They got the money from the government, from taxpayers. The plans were managed. And if there's a shortage now, you have to ask the defense firm, did you use it to pay for restructuring? Did you pay retiree health care benefits? Did you use a so-called QSERP and use it to help pay for your executive compensation? Did you transfer, like Raytheon did, an extra, you know, $1 billion in a deal? You have to ask them that. So it's, I don't know if I've answered your question about
I'm familiar with the Service Contract Act and what they're supposed to be doing.
Sure.
But I guess my second question, and then I'll have a third, and I'll get off the soapbox here, Mr. Chair. The second one is what about federal and state plans? Obviously, you know, most of these, as you well know, these companies have gone in and done this, and state laws either allowed them to do it, or there wasn't a state law, or a federal law in many cases. For the most part, federal interstate commerce laws and federal insurance regulation laws allowed them to do this. But likewise, what about states and community and, we'll say, public sector retirement plans who kind of, frankly, use the same set of laws to
actually
make the books look bad?
Glad you bring that up. There are no state regulations on pensions. Anything that's in the benefit system, whether it's public or private, is covered by federal law, federal ERISA. And that has its funding rules, which we've seen are so often ignored. It has rules about what companies can do with plans. And the IRS, of course, also has rules on what companies can do. I did find, though, the same consulting firms that worked with employers so closely to help them devise ways to profit from their plans, which is, working at the Wall Street Journal 21 years, is something I understand. You have to manage everything in your universe practically, and with an eye towards keeping the company running and keeping it solvent. I think people went a little overboard with that. But the consulting firms also worked with the public sector. And it was sort of a reverse dynamic. In the private sector, I found that they secretly cut benefits and exaggerated their problems, saying, oh, woe is me, the sky is falling. You know, we can't afford pensions. Flip that over in the public sector, and basically it was to award additional benefits for various reasons, but hide the effect. So you see the exact opposite happening. The underlying mechanism, though, has been the accounting, you know, the ways that you calculate what the liabilities are, and you can manipulate that in so many ways, you know, to make them go up, make them go down. Why would you make liabilities go up? Let's say your private plan. Let's say you're going to award stock options, there might be something influencing you that you're not really sharing with the public about causing a plan's liabilities to fall precipitously if someone's going to need a pop to earnings, get the stock price up. You might inflate the liabilities if you're going into union negotiations in the next year, and you will go in and say, gosh, look, our pension liabilities just spiked, our retiree health liabilities. It's very easy for me to look in a private plan and see if those liabilities have spiked because you changed the discount rate or changed about five other assumptions, and that's the only thing that changed. You know, it just jumped it right up there. So the other reason you might spike it and then drop it is that it generates income, because if it's gone up and then you take it down, that's a reversal of liability, and then it helps your earnings when you need it to help.
One final question. Yes. As you pointed out, it's all federal laws that for a lot impacting this. Social Security, I mean, it's an unfunded liability. I mean, the government's borrowing 40 cents on every dollar right now, and as I openly stated and always get beat up even by my Republican colleagues, that, you know, defense has got to be whacked 25% to 40% in real dollars just to keep the country afloat within the next couple of years. But it comes back to Social Security. I mean, it's in bad shape, period.
I have looked at Social Security, and I don't have figures with me to speak confidently, extemporaneously. However, I tend not to be someone who's has an overly rosy outlook of things, and I was not as alarmed as people generally are when they talk about Social Security. With some modest changes, a lot of the shortfall can be made up, and one of those changes is if you just increase the taxable wage base, which is now, I believe, at $106,800, raising that, and I forget what the cutoff is, it's fairly low, like $200,000, would take care of a quarter of the funding problems at least. And there are other things that can be done. So I actually don't lose sleep at night worrying about the Social Security system. I do worry about the private system, obviously, because it seems, thanks to these practices, imperiled. And also in looking at the public sector, again, there have been, of course, great reports of abuses here and there, and there are abuses. I do find people spiking their pensions in some places, which, mind you, executives do. You look at the filings. It's not as dire as people portray it collectively. Yes, there's underfunding, but unlike the private system, they do have a longer time horizon. I do see a lot of people, on depending on what they're trying to convey about the public system, either using formulas that make the plans look less funded or more funded. So it would be nice if people were able, we were able to get like a level playing field where we're all sort of talking using the same terms or agreeing
oranges,
where the wiggle
yeah.
room is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, Senator George.
Alan, one of the beautiful things about having iPads is I just bought your book.
Your sales
but,
just
yeah, I did. Honestly, one of the things that I did before I became a legislator was I actually had a radio show in Portland for about 10 years, and I spent a great deal of time between 1995 and really 2002, spent a lot of time on pension plans. Because what shocked me was is that we had companies who would use their defined benefit programs and lower or increase the risk by aggressively changing their projections on return on the pension plan, then taking those funds and doing leveraged buyouts. In fact, we had a very high-profile one that was done exactly like that here in the state of Oregon, where a company took the pension program, changed it from a 7% return to a 9% return, then took those as profits as a leverage to do a buyout here in the state of Oregon. It was shocking to me that this was happening, and it happened all the time during that 95 to 2005 time. And I mean, I spent a lot of time trying to draw attention to it, and it's difficult to explain because it's rather boring to people. but I mean, one of the reasons I was going through school, and one of the reasons I quit my major, which was accounting, is because I could not understand how people could justify pensions, and especially defined benefit pension programs within accounting rules, because it seemed like the accounting rules were an ever-adopting facade.
They're kind of poetry. Actually, it's they have so much flexibility, and what you're talking about is by changing the expected rate of return, like how much are the assets expected to return, that's a way to raise or lower the liability. Simple. So if you want to look better funded because you're going to sell a company, then you raise the expected return, and suddenly you look better funded, get more for your company. And yes, it's very, very, very common.
So this was one of my concerns. And then on the public side, one of the things that I think bothered me the most during the same exact time was in our own PERS system, What we did was, is we have this guaranteed 8% for tier one employees. And what we did was, when the dot-com bubble hit, we basically changed that trajectory by adding money in a lump sum at the time. And we changed the trajectory for all the tier one employees. So what we did was, is that something that was an 8% guarantee then changed at 1 year to have nearly a 20% return, which forever changed that in the future. So now what we've got is a system where we can hold up tier one employees and say, look at these outrageous returns, and who's getting hurt by that is people who are now becoming public employees who are seeing cut budgets and then also seeing a tier four, basically a defined contribution plan here in the state. So what you have is a double whammy, because the people who were tier one got all the benefits of basically this future promise. The politicians at the time didn't have to fund it, right?
Right.
And then now we have to fund their decisions from the 1990s and 1980s, and we're doing it on the back of the workers who are coming to work for us now in the state. And to me, the whole thing seems like, within these defined benefit programs, is I can make promises today that I don't have to pay for 20 years, so I never have to pay for it. It's some other executive, some shareholder, or the employees, and I get the benefit of doing it, but yes, the ramifications is not for 20 years out. And unfortunately for us here in the state of Oregon, that ramification is right now, and we're going to take it out on public employees who have just entered our workforce in the last few years.
Yes.
It's crazy.
It is, and the same sort of temptation, mental temptation, took place in the private sector, where, again, if someone's negotiating with unions, you'll say, all right, what we're going to do is, we'll give you less pay now, but we'll give you more on the end. You know, we'll give you more pension or retiree health care. So current management doesn't mind. They're going to pass the buck to the future. And, of course, what happened, it worked well for a while because plans were well funded. Then future management comes in, whether it's a private equity firm or somebody else, says, well, now, you know, I know we're supposed to pay this out, but let's find ways not to pay it. You know, let's find a way to not pay the retiree health benefits. You know, get into the courts, use some novel legal ideas, cut pensions, freeze pensions. The problem is you sort of hit a wall after a while. You can cut pensions like companies did, like IBM cut pensions like five times in the 90s and nobody noticed until the end. And then you do the ultimate cut, which is you freeze the plan. So it's not ever going to grow anymore. You sort of reach that point. Now what can you do? Well, you're probably not going to terminate the plan, obviously not, if you're a going concern and the plan is underfunded, because you would have to come up with the additional money to pay it out. So you're not going to do that. If you're going to go over a cliff, sure, you can stop funding it and then do your best to dump it on the PBGC. So it is a question of people passing the buck, and in the whole trend in the corporate arena of getting short-term gains. You know, everything was focused on the short term. You're not really building a company that's going to last forever, because you're going to come in there, be there a few years, and go out with your nice exit package.
Senator Rosemont, and then thank Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this, I have two questions. There could be a million questions on this topic, but this might be more for Doug, but anybody who can answer it. One thing neither of you talked about was the issue of turnover among employees. I mean, certainly in this crisis economy with, you know, 100 people applying for jobs as a bank teller, it's hard to get a job. But in sort of a more normal employment situation, if you went back even 3 years before the recession hit, it seems like the statistics about the number of jobs people were going to have in a lifetime are pretty staggering compared to when I started out in the workforce. And so are there models, successful models of pension portability that would address the problems of people who go from one job to another and just don't stay long enough to vest in a pension plan anywhere? And I guess I'll just leave it at that question.
Yes, there's two things there. One is that there's a misconception that there was all of this mobility. The mobility, yes, among younger employees that might change jobs 9 times before they're 35, but mobility once people hit 40 was not, people stuck with their jobs, got to their 50s, they sure wanted to hang on to that job to sort of see it through to the time they got their pension and Medicare eligibility. So there was no mobility there, which is why companies came up with these techniques to get them out. You know, like, well, if you leave, we'll give you retiree health care and some extra payout from the pension plan. So that was to increase mobility. They really wanted them out Of course, the downside for people like Unisys employees was they took that package, and then a couple years later, their health care was canceled. So with the mobility we have now, there are models that could work. The problem is, take a 401k. It's essentially portable because it's a separate account. You own the assets. People still spend it. They spend it. What about pension? Problem with pensions is that generally the five-year vesting rule takes care of everybody. You know, they're not going to invest in that pension. And even now, though, at many companies it's come to 3 years, you're not going to vest if you're moving around in that period. What has been proposed is possibly trying to have the ability to roll a defined benefit pension from one entity to another, or to have some kind of government transfer effect so that the assets stay in the system and are, you know, managed professionally and not spent. But it's been very difficult for people to implement things that address that now.
And if I could just add to that, we do know quite certainly that employers who have good benefits packages offer paid sick leave. That whole constellation of treating workers with respect reduces turnover, reduces, you know, the costs of retraining employees, et cetera. It's actually smart business practice to treat your workers well.
Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just reading your interview on the AARP website, and I know that we have a representative from AARP coming up here. Question I had is there anything at the state level we can do? I'm assuming this is more, because I haven't heard, okay, so what do we need to do here? You know, I'm assuming it's more at a federal level as far as changing accounting rules, but is there anything at the state level we can do, or sending a message to our congressional delegation that obviously this is a big problem that needs special attention? So curious, I haven't read your book, and it'll be interesting once we read it, but do you have recommendations or suggestions about moving forward?
I wish I had good ones, because as you know, when companies have found ways to take what would have been retiree health benefits or pensions from their retired workers, that benefits the shareholders and the executives, but it doesn't benefit the taxpayers, mm-hmm. because if people, you know, when they get old and they can't afford things, they end up using public services. And that, I think that we're at the beginning of seeing what will be a huge additional pressure, because we came through the golden age of retirement, you know, the post-World War I period, where we had pensions and retiree health care and so forth. Now, we've seen that it's under assault, and a lot of those people who are counting on that aren't going to get it, or their spouses. You know, if you look at the widows of people who were, you know, career AT&T employees, they don't have retiree health, they don't have death benefit, they don't have all those things. So the trick is, what can you do on a state level? You know, I have seen occasionally pressure brought to bear on a company if it's going to change something. There's a big outcry. I've seen companies back off, but I haven't studied the long-term effects. Like, did they continue to back off, or did they, you know, a few years later go through with it? So I really have no suggestions.
Well, maybe we'll hear from some of the other speakers that are coming up.
I will say I looked into whether or not it was lawful in Oregon for a company to purchase a life insurance policy on its employees without their knowledge, and was told by LC that that is unlawful, that a bill was passed in prior legislators.
Chairman Shields, in 2006, Congress passed a rule that said that you must get consent from the person. The problem with that rule was that it wasn't retroactive, so that there are millions and millions of people who did not get, you know, they have no idea that they're covered by one of these policies, and you can't compel a company to tell you. So the other problem with that was that it affirmed companies' ability to purchase life insurance. So what is more common now is a company will tell someone, well, look, if you sign here and allow us to buy insurance on you, which we're going to use to finance retiree benefits, and people always assume it's like retiree health when it's not, then we will give you a little insurance on your, you know, separate amount. If people go for that, they don't understand necessarily how much insurance is being taken out on them. Of course, the younger you are, the larger the policy, because companies can put more in there actuarially.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, at least in the insurance world, the state has a lot of authority on regulating insurance. We have virtually none in, I mean, very little when it comes to the banking and pension world. But it would seem that we could regulate the life insurance aspect of that more readily than we could other things related to pensions.
Yes, I believe you still have some power there.
Yeah. Senator George.
I often thought in doing all the interviews when I was doing this is that one of the things that we miss was, in essence, when you have a defined contribution program, especially for younger folks, is if you actually had it in a silo where people couldn't access those funds, borrow against those funds, in essence, create almost like a Social Security system, except with a defined contribution program where you put those money in and you could not touch them until, I mean, no matter what you wanted to do, until you hit retirement, would be an interesting system. Because what you do is you do it. And I look at a country like Chile that has a kind of a traditional Social Security system, and then they have an actual silo upon where younger folks could access that thing, and they've seen huge, huge benefits to their folks on that. I spent a lot of time in Chile, and the view on that is just so optimistic that so many people are seeing, in essence, when they know they're going to hit retirement, there's just a huge pot of money there for them that's in their private system. And it seems like to me if we could create a system in the United States where you had a 401k system, but you didn't have all the fees backloaded on it, and if you had a system where people couldn't access it and basically drained it before they retired, that would actually be the best system that people's name is on it and nobody can rate it like we're seeing the defined benefit programs have.
Yes, you're describing the New Zealand system, actually, where it's a sort of a form of forced savings and the money is professionally managed, it's locked up, you can't get access to it, and that's fairly successful. It's only a decade or two. I'm not sure how old the system is, but so far it's solved a lot of those problems.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Chairman Shield. Thank you, Chairman Shield.
Let's bring up the next panel. Daniel Rodriguez and Kit Good. You know, actually, Ellen, before you go, could I ask you, could you come back up to the dais and answer one question for me? I mean, we have a treasurer that invests a whole lot of our funds, and we often go to private equity funds that have the greatest return, yet they're often the ones who are laying off a whole lot of workers once they purchase a company, and then are also involved in a lot of the manipulations that you're talking about. In your experience, did you come across one or two that really were in a league of themselves with pushing the envelope on the more nefarious activity?
When you say the company themselves, you're talking about
the private equity firms that you found to be most aggressive in abusing their authority.
Well, the problem with private equity is it's private. They don't have to file most of the things that I normally look at to see what their assumptions are. So I have absolutely no idea what they're doing with the assumptions. It usually would only come up if they get into bankruptcy court, and then, of course, they must be disclosing the assumptions they're using. But up until they reach that point, you won't know.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Chairman.
Sorry about that false start. Next panel.
Thank you. My name is Daniel Rodriguez, and I represent AARP, and I am a retired volunteer. So I need to put that out there initially. And the essence of my comments are to inform you what AARP is doing in the planning and preparation for retirement security for the 500,000 members that we currently have in the state of Oregon. And that planning and preparation is both from the AARP Oregon, and I will allude to some of the activities that AARP National has undergone and will soon undertake with respect to these issues. Clearly, AARP promulgates the four pillars of retirement security are Social Security, employer-provided pensions, employment, and access to health care. And it's no surprise that we lead with Social Security, which actually provides, astonishingly in the state of Oregon, it keeps 43% of Oregonians 65 and above out of poverty, which is an alarming figure, but it is what it is. And while I may be the first person to ever disagree with Senator Borkus, Social Security is not broken. It, under its current state, under the present means and by which it delivers the payment, it will remain solvent until 2036, after which then 25%, if nothing is done, 25% fewer dollars will be dispensed until 2082. So clearly that is something that needs to happen in that time were we to continue that. And that's where AARP National will soon be undertake a national Social Security campaign to address the issues. What needs to be done from 2036 to 2082 to maintain that current level? And AARP is well aware that one of the strengths of Social Security is that it has been non-political. That has been shattered, and we now find ourselves in the middle of a political discussion as to how that might be tweaked to keep it at the 2036 level through 2082. Okay, I'm not the numbers person, that my predecessors were, so I'll just leave it at that. And so that's where we are right there. And so we do that, and we promulgate those as often as we possibly can. The next area is employer-provided prevention pensions with respect to what we do. AARP will soon and has begun investigating what is called state-assisted savings, a relatively new approach to broaden coverage to make 401k type plans available to small private companies. AARP National has not jumped into that, but they soon shall. It is in clearly the planning stages. While most states would require congressional action, several states are exploring the opportunities related to state-assisted savings. This is all meant to increase the pool of savings amount available to its retiree members. The boomers, as we're all lovingly called, are in a situation where sometimes the savings that we had have been reduced. We're looking for other areas. Employment. I provide seminars to people 50 and above who, through no fault of their own, need to return to the workforce. And it is both exciting and discouraging to have the workshops that I provide throughout the state easily have 180 and above constant in attention in attendance, because that's what they need to do. They need to go back. They have lost their in many cases their pensions from private companies. They need to go back to work. So we just need to provide that opportunity on the planning and the present section for our members who have to go back to work and do whatever they need to do. And so that provides a significant amount of information that we provide to our members. And finally, access to health care. I previously said that one of the strengths of Social Security is that it was devoid of political involvement, which has changed a little bit. Access to health care does not fall under that category. It is absolutely in the political arena, and the AARP nationally has said that our goal is to maintain as many benefits as we can, realizing that the access to health care issue will be a long and arduous battle, and one that which AARP supports all the way. Recently, if some of you who are AARP members, and I hope some of you can smile when I say that to you, you'll go to the AARP website. We now have, for our members, Social Security benefits calculators, retirement calculator, to have people look at what it is that they could possibly have given the information that they have in their own portfolio, 401 contributions calculator, and 401 fee calculator, all designed to help people. We do not want our members to go blindly into retirement. We want them to plan, understand when it is that they choose to take Social Security, what plan they need to tweak, if they need to get a job, how we can help them, because many of the people 50 and above must re-career. And so with that comes the planning and the training that we can provide. And so we have all that available. AARP Oregon works closely with AARP National in what we can and cannot do. The plans for Social Security will be, I think, brought out in early February. Ongoing information from AARP National on health care is constantly out there. But that, like most of the other issues, is awaiting the national elections, as that has befallen us and in many cases held us up on a number of things. So, but my comments are merely to let you know what we are trying to do for our members as they plan for retirement.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, and the members of the committee. My name is Kit Good, and I'm a member of the SEIU Union 503. And as an in-home care provider, I also manage apartments, a senior apartment complex here in town. I did have a retirement plan all set, but upon the passing of my employer and now the sale of the apartment complex, I've seen that dwindle. It's gone away. So I am having to re-educate myself every career. Excuse me, I don't do this. I will read from my notes if you don't mind. And now I'm unsure if I'm going to even be able to retire. I really don't know how I'm going to. Since the passing of my husband, I've had 3 jobs full-time, 7 days a week. And I continue to do such. I've raised 4 grandchildren, and I might add, without any state help or child support. But as an in-home care worker, I see individuals every day who are reliant upon public services to meet their quality of life. I see firsthand the true cost of retirement. I would like to be able to retire independently and have the ability to take care of all my own needs, but that is looking less and less likely. This problem is not unique to me. This situation is one that everyone in our state faces and one that needs to be addressed for all Oregonians who are facing the uncertainty of their retirement security. We need a solution here in our state, and most importantly, we need to start the discussion of retirement and what the true cost of being retired really is. Social Security is often not enough to provide for the basic needs of the individuals, leaving the state to pick up the rest of the tab. I call upon you as our elected officials to help us engage this discussion and to be proactive about this problem, because if we don't do something now, we will be facing a much larger crisis in the future. We need to engage the entire state on this issue and start working towards retirement security for all Oregonians. I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Senator George.
Thank you. One of the things I want to kind of talk a little bit about the AARP, one of the things that is interesting to me is that we have people who are just living off Social Security and they can't make it. We know that. And incredibly, incredibly poor if you try to live exclusively off Social Security. And Social Security has become a pay-as-you-go system, which means there's no trust fund there. I mean, if we've borrowed all the money, it's empty. It's like we keep putting IOUs in a cookie jar. And I'm kind of... just from a national perspective on the AARP, I don't see any effort in the AARP nationally to kind of address some of these fundamental issues, because what Social Security has become is the biggest transfer of wealth from the working class to the wealthiest segment of our population. I mean, those people over 65, there's incredibly wealthy people here who are getting a check every month, mm-hmm. and it's being taken out of people who are making minimum wage. And then, so there's no means testing to it. There's no length of service. Of course, the retirement age hasn't been going up to match how long we're living. There's a whole number of things that are, in essence, weakening the system. And it seems like to me the AARP has sort of blocked any discussion about that, especially when we start talking about what this really is, which is this wealth transfer from the working class to the rich. And I'm trying to get at that because I don't understand why the AARP defends these millionaires and billionaires get a check every month while we have people who can barely pay their heating bill.
Well, the term you use, why has AARP blocked that? AARP was prepared to come out at the national level last spring with the means testing, as the previous person said, raising the income from 106 to 2,000 estate taxes. I mean, there's a whole number of issues that were ready to go on. The discussion, and I say that politely, on the debt ceiling prompted AARP National just to back off, just to see where that would go, because then at that particular point, everyone was soured on everything to do with Washington. The national campaign that is scheduled to begin next month will discuss the means testing, what the trust fund, all those issues will come forward, because AARP does not recognize that Social Security is devoid of a solution. In fact, it requires a solution, and so that's what's going to be coming very shortly on that one.
I guess my main point is that Social Security is viewed as like the backbone for most people's retirement, and what I feel like is people think that we can maintain this system that we have, kind of betting that the next generation will cover the bill without us really taking the hits. And I look at, you know, people I know who paid 1.5-2% of their salary into Social Security, and you know, my grandmother's 92 and she's still getting a check from Social Security, having retired 30 some odd years ago. That was never expected when she was paying 2-3% into Social Security when she was in the workforce for a lot of years. And so what we have is a system that is basically continuing to kick the ball down the field so that retirees today are getting a benefit that's basically being borrowed from the children and their grandchildren. And it seems like to me that there's some really quick and easy ways to re-get it back on the right track, so that what we're actually doing is helping the people it was designed to help, which is those people who were in the working class section who were not able to amass a personal wealth.
Right. And those quick and easy ways will be addressed very shortly as the time has come to look at some of the modifications.
Thank you.
Good. Any further questions? Thank you very much for coming to testify. We really appreciate you being here. And to the rest of the panel, we really appreciate you bringing these issues to the fore, particularly our guests who traveled from out of state. So I will close the informational meeting on retirement security in the public and private sectors and open an informational hearing on Oregon Home Ownership Stabilization Initiative. I understand one of our presenters has to get on the road momentarily, and so we would be happy to give her the courtesy of going first. Welcome to the committee. I understood that one of your homeowners who is going to be testifying needs to get to a job interview. Is that correct?
At 10. That's correct. Are we?
Should we let him go maybe first? Would it be possible to let him go first?
Yes, absolutely.
Perfect.
Is that Adam?
Thank you for accommodating the awkward switch here. My name is Adam Wagner. I live in Lake Oswego, Oregon, and I am a small business owner, and I have a family of five. I have a higher education MBA, and last year I was faced with a very scary situation. My business was just really severely affected by the economy. I found myself in a position where I had to put everything into my company to save it. I had no income. I had no way of paying. For the first time in my life, I had no way of paying my bills or my mortgage. And I had received all the help I can get from friends and family. So about 2 days before the deadline, I found out about this program and submitted my application, was lucky enough to be accepted. Had I not been accepted to the program, I definitely would have lost my house, and I honestly don't know what I would have done. It gave me an amazing opportunity to concentrate on my business, to save my business, to keep my family together, and to stay in my house. And so now that the program is about to end, it looks like I will be able to stay in my house. So it has been a very easy process for me. I've gone through an audit with them, and everybody's been very helpful. I couldn't say enough good things about it. It really has put me in a very strong position to survive.
Thank you, Mr. Wagner. Could you walk, you don't have to tell us specific dollar amounts, but can you walk us through the process and how, the mechanics of how it actually helped you? Was it through decreasing the principal or a payment plan, or how did it work exactly?
Well, they took over the monthly payments for my mortgage, which was an excess, at the time had become an excessive burden. So that freed up the resources and the pressure on me and my family to put the money elsewhere to try to pay down some additional debt and pay my bills as well. So, but yeah, so it was an automated program. They paid my monthly mortgage. Next month, February is the last payment. July was the first payment. So from July through February, it's all been in their hands. They've taken care of everything. They've been in communication with my bank, and worked all that out for me.
That's great. Do you have employees?
I had 13 employees.
And are any of them still employed with the firm?
No, unfortunately, we decided that just a few weeks ago, we decided that we would end the business. It was after 2 years of hardship, but we ended on a good note. But you know, we did recover a little bit this year, but we just decided that it was time to call it a day.
And is that free and clear, or do you have to pay any of this back, or how does that mechanic part of it work?
As far as the program goes?
Yeah.
It's not free and clear. It is a five-year forgivable loan. So for each year I stay in the home, a percentage of it is forgiven, and there's no prepayment or no non-payment penalty, so I don't have to pay it back. If I sold my house for a profit, I would have to refund the money.
Gotcha. Okay. Any questions? Great. Thank you. We'll let you get to your.
I really appreciate
your next appointment.
Letting me go first. I know
thanks
it's
for coming
order.
Down to
yeah,
to,
thank you.
To tell about your success there. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Shields and members of the committee. My name is Margaret Van Vliet. I'm the Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. With me is Mike Ahman. He's the Administrator of the Oregon Homeownership Stabilization Initiative Program that my agency runs. Really glad to be here. Very much appreciate the committee's interest in what is obviously a very pressing issue for many Oregonians who are struggling. Like Mr. Wagner, and we do have one other homeowner here today that we'll get to quickly, because I know it's more interesting to hear stories of real people than from those of us that you hear from frequently. I'm going to give you just a little bit of background, answer a few questions that the chair had asked that we sort of take up. You're receiving some packets with some additional information that you can sort of peruse here. I think you may know that this program came to us in the last couple of years. It wasn't a funding source that we applied for. Oregon had the honor of receiving what at the end was $220 million from U.S. Department of Treasury, because we were one of 19 states across the country that was deemed hardest hit by the economic recession. We've been working for the last 18 months or so to understand Treasury's intent, to understand how to apply it here in Oregon, and to get as much money out on the ground as we possibly can. I don't have to tell members of this committee that the need is great. For foreclosure assistance. By our estimates, in 2010, some 28,000 Oregonians entered the foreclosure process. I think it was a similar number in 2011. At the most, we're going to be able to help roughly 13,000 when we spend all of the allocated funds. So we're not going to meet everybody's need. It's not a perfect match for everybody who's in need. We're working hard to sort of target and do it as well as possible. As of today, we've helped a little more than 4,000 homeowners like Mr. Wagner, and it's about $40 million in assistance out the door of the total 220. I should note that we are actually ahead of the other states in this regard. All of our colleague states have really struggled to get programs up and get money out the door. We're ahead of the pack and receive praise from Treasury in that regard. The very specific statistics are available in the report that you have a hard copy of today. That's on our website. It comes out quarterly. It's what Treasury asks us to account for to them, and I think there's some helpful statistics. I also want to recognize that my agency has frankly struggled a bit to get this program up and running. We hit a few snags along the way. Perhaps you have some familiarity with that. So I don't want to sugarcoat this. It's been a little bit of a bumpy ride. But we have taken very concrete steps to smooth things out operationally. We were overwhelmed. We didn't fully staff up at the beginning. We have recently put in place a plan to get the staff we need at the dollar amount Treasury wants us to spend on administrative costs to get this money out the door. I will note for you that in the context of our hiring freeze statewide, we did get an exemption both from our Ways and Means Subcommittee and from the executive branch process for hiring in the context of the freeze. The basic reason that those were approved was that these are limited duration positions for a very pressing situation throughout Oregon communities and that it's federal funds. So based on those factors, we've gotten authorization to move forward to really staff up at the level we think is appropriate. We've worked hard on communications so that people know what to expect and so that they can access information and we can be more responsive. Mike can talk a little bit about that. And then we've worked to really streamline operations and make it a more simple process both for consumers and for ourselves. And we've smoothed out interactions with the 150 servicers that we interact with every month to make the mortgage payments for all these individuals. So I think I will stop there. I'm going to turn it over again to Mike Aumann. He's fairly new in his role. I want to emphasize I have full confidence in Mike's ability to continue to lead this program and do it in a way that meets everybody's needs. So thank you.
For the record, I'm Mike Aumann. I'm the administrator for the Oregon Homeownership Stabilization Initiative. I would just like to briefly begin by describing what the Mortgage Payment Assistance Program is. Much as Mr. Wagner alluded to, it is a program which pays the direct mortgage for clients in our program for 1 year or $20,000, whichever comes first. The assistance is in a soft, non-recourse second loan, forgivable over a 5-year period, 20% per year. The loan is only repayable should the home be sold sometime within that 5 period where a net profit was realized. The program is really acting as a life preserver for many homeowners struggling to regain their financial stability in these economic times that we're facing. I want to hit on the eligibility criteria. In our first round of mortgage payment assistance, to qualify, participants had to demonstrate an economic hardship or distress. There were other eligibility elements, including that they couldn't be in active bankruptcy. They had to own a single-family home. It was a detached dwelling. There was some income restrictions around that regarding state median income. The program was available to homeowners that were underemployed as well as small business owners. We really wrapped up that first round, and we're looking at a second launch of the Mortgage Payment Assistance Program, and this time our focus will be on unemployed people. The approach is in response to Oregon's struggling unemployment rate, and we are also have been encouraged by the U.S. Department of Treasury to address this population with this program. This mortgage payment assistance, the unemployment program, is going to be available to homeowners that are receiving unemployment at the time of their application and where their servicers are participating. And again, we've got 150 servicers that have agreed to participate with us. In terms of the allocation of assistance and how we allocated that throughout Oregon, initially the county-based allocations were made, and we concentrated our efforts on changing home values, delinquencies, and foreclosures. The allocation ensured that every county in Oregon would have the opportunity to benefit from this program. And after the application period closed, we found that some counties, notably rural Oregon, was unable to fill all of their allocation for that county. In our second round, as we launch the new program, we are looking to honor those commitments made to those counties, to those rural Oregon counties where we needed to allow them time to fill those allocations. We have also added additional slots to all counties in Oregon, and those will be available in the second round as well. We expect this new round of mortgage payment assistance to help in approximately 3,000 new homeowners throughout the state. We've begun a phased launch of the new program, and it is already available in Klamath and Lake counties as a pilot. Later this month, we will open additional 5 counties, and every 2 weeks after that, we will add counties until we are statewide on March, early March. Once all the counties have had sufficient time to utilize their allocations to get people into the program, we will then move to a first-come, first-served basis statewide at Treasury's request to get these funds out to homeowners who need them.
Excuse me, what was the date on when it's going to be first-come, first-served basis?
We're looking probably at the July timeframe for that.
Okay. July 1, July 31st?
I'm going to say mid-July at this point. Again, we had some dates that were pretty firm, and the hiring freeze, because of the exception request processes that we need to go through, has really put us about 30 days behind in terms of staffing up to be able to handle the response we're expecting.
Okay.
All of our information in terms of county scheduling, when this program is available in counties, the comprehensive instructions about how to apply for the program, as well as quarterly report information and stats about how we are doing, is all available on our webpage. I'm happy to take questions. As you've already heard, we do have some invited guests, and I want to make sure that you have time to hear from them.
Questions? I do have a couple of questions for you. So you have objectives and goals set for each particular county as you roll the next phase out at this point? Is that part of your presentation?
Slots. Is how we refer to those, correct.
And that's what you shared with me when we met, right?
Correct.
And
correct.
Is that in the packet, the
information that you're
presenting?
It should be in the packet.
That
is that not?
I don't believe
it's supposed to be in the packet. Sorry about that. That's an oversight. It
okay.
should have been in the
do
packet.
Do you have it with you?
I don't have it with me. Do you have it with you?
I do not.
Anybody have the slots with them? My apologies. That's embarrassing.
No problem. I mean, the one thing that jumped out at me, if I could, that please. I had some concerns about, maybe you could help me understand it, is that, you know, probably 25% of the people who are struggling with making payments on their houses are in my county, but mm-hmm. The number of slots didn't seem to anywhere reflect that percentage. Is that perception correct still?
I'm not sure how to answer that exactly. I do have one copy of the slots that I'm happy to share.
Could you make copies? We'll get copies for the community.
We'll get that to everybody via email.
No, actually, I think I'd like to get it
now. You can
now.
Do that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks.
We have technology. Sorry, a little misstep there.
Okay. Well, why don't we move on to the next steps of the presentation and...
And then we'll come back, obviously, and we can answer more questions and maybe go into the slots question a little more.
Great.
That'd be great.
Could I ask one question, though,
sure.
before we move on? I just was curious about the audit portion of the previous, not this new unemployment-related program, but the program that started a year or whenever ago that was. So I can't tell if there are statistics here about the number of people who were initially deemed eligible and then later found ineligible. I don't know how common that is. I just heard from somebody that happened to. Could you talk a little bit about how that, why that happened and how common it is?
Certainly, Chair, Senator. We you know, to be good stewards of the funding, we had a requirement for people to maintain eligibility throughout the program, throughout the 12-month cycle that they were in. We also required a monthly verification from them. We required some steps of them to go through the homeowner education process. And along the way, we, of course, ask for those. Many people, you know, come forward and say that for whatever reason they no longer do qualify. At the same time, we do have an audit program where we go back through files and check and do random audit checks of constituents that are in the program. And where we find any inconsistency, again, to be good stewards of the funding, we terminate them from the program.
So if I could just follow up, that audit function then is being done by the department, not by these partners that are doing the initial assessment?
Right? That is correct. U.S. Treasury, Chair, Senator, the Treasury has requested us to have an audit function in-house, and in discussions with them, I don't believe that having some third-party community action partner would be an adequate response to their request.
So do you have an idea of how many people have been kicked off the program involuntarily like that?
I don't have those stats with me today, but we can certainly get that information to you.
Thanks.
On this document, there are three figures: number of unique borrowers receiving assistance, 4426. Number of unique borrowers denied assistance, 5,103. And then number of unique borrowers withdrawn from the program, 8686. Does that address Senator Rosenbaum's question, or are those different statistics?
Chair, Senator, it addresses them in terms of how we need to report the information to U.S. Treasury. I don't believe it specifically addresses her question to the level and granularity that we can address it.
Can you tell me what who the borrowers are withdrawn from the program?
Yeah, certainly, Chair. We had an overwhelming response, shall we say, when we launched this program in December of 2010. We had almost 19,000 applications in a six-week period. Because we had to go through a process to evaluate all of those applications to determine and make a determination about whether we could provide assistance or whether we couldn't, we have to report almost on all 19,000 of those people, and for Treasury's purposes, put them into one of these categories. So where people failed to demonstrate maybe a loss of income, or where their property value was too high, again, because we had to make a determination, we had to wind up putting them into these categories for U.S. Treasury's purposes. I don't believe it really gets to the question at hand.
We do have this document in front of us now, and I'm pleased to see that the numbers aren't as stark as I remember them being, that Multnomah County has under its percentage of the population, I believe, but at least within within 10 or 15%. Which
the population was taken into account in this version of the formula.
Hmm. And could you explain the rest of the formula and how you arrived at these numbers?
Chair, in the original program allocation, we looked again at foreclosure rates, we looked at home values, we looked at many factors. This new allocation is more population driven.
Okay. And so just to clarify, this document has number 6 on it, lists the counties as 400 new slots. This is for the upcoming program.
Correct.
This document here that says Oregon HFA performance data, that is recipients to date.
Correct.
Good. Thank you very much. Questions? All right. Let's proceed with the rest of the panel. And colleagues, I think this is going to be recorded, and I'm going to get a copy of the DVD and try to get this up onto the web so that you can direct your constituents to it when they have questions.
Good afternoon, Chair Shields, members of the committee. My name is Emily Ryman, and I am the Opportunity Works Manager for NEDCO, the Neighborhood Economic Development Corporation. NEDCO is a nonprofit CDC serving Lane and Marion counties, and we are one of the contracted agency partners to administer the mortgage payment assistance program in our territories. For the purpose of the MPA program, we also cover Clackamas County, so we provide services for residents in Clackamas as well, just as they extend to the MPA program. The Opportunity Works Department that I manage at NEDCO oversees the financial literacy programs, the homeownership programs, and the foreclosure prevention counseling programs that we offer. OHSI asked me to come today to talk a little bit about the role of the agency partners in the MPA program, NEDCO's experience with that, and the relationship between the hardest hit funds and foreclosure counseling in general. In order to do that, I'd like to talk for just a moment about what our services and what our world was like before the Mortgage Payment Assistance Program began and before the state received the hardest hit funds. NEDCO actually has provided home ownership counseling since the 1990s, but during that time it was primarily helping low-income and minority families purchase their first home. We also did a lot of financial literacy education on behalf of those homeowners so that they were attaining smart and sustainable home ownership. In 2007 and 2008, because we are a state-designated regional housing center and also a HUD-approved housing counseling agency, we began receiving the first calls from homeowners who were at risk of losing their property, had lost their jobs, were struggling financially, and they didn't know where to turn, so they came to us. Completely as a result of that community need, our housing counselors were trained and certified then as foreclosure counselors as well. And in 2008, we began offering foreclosure prevention workshops and foreclosure counseling. Since that time, we've seen a steady and significant rise in the demand for services every year, and we really don't see that changing. 90-day default notices in our counties are holding steady. The attendance at our workshops is holding steady, and the people seeking our services don't seem to be going anywhere. I think everyone in this room is probably familiar with the state of the foreclosure world right now, and I would just like to say that all the worst stories that you've heard are probably true in terms of the difficulty that homeowners face when they're trying to work with servicers to get some kind of a solution that will help them save their home or that will help them exit their home with the least financial loss possible. We work with families on a regular basis that have been trying for 2 years or more to work on a modification with their servicer. We regularly see families who complete every step of the trial modification process, make every payment on time, and nothing about their circumstance has changed, but they're eventually denied for a permanent modification, with no reason cited by the servicer. We also see people on a far too regular basis who are in a worse position financially after they try to work with their servicer than when they first reached out for help in the first place. In the midst of what is a very broken industry and a very broken servicing process right now, foreclosure counseling holds a little bit of a unique position, and it's often a frustrating and daunting field. We have success stories for sure, and those success stories keep us going, but oftentimes the successes aren't really ones we can celebrate, because in our world a success might be helping a family come to the decision that they have to let their home go. Too often we're triaging clients who have no time and no breathing room, and we're helping coach them to what is the least bad of a spectrum of very bad options. And they don't have time to better their financial position. We can help provide them with information. We can help them understand their position and the options that might be available to them. We can help them analyze their financial situation. And we can help support them and advocate for them while they try to negotiate with their servicers. Those are all powerful things, and it's no small feat for a homeowner who's been struggling for years to finally have the information they need to move forward. But the unique thing about the situation is that before hardest hit funds, before the Mortgage Payment Assistance Program, we really didn't have any sort of tangible assistance to provide to homeowners. We could provide that information. We could provide the advocacy. Our counselors are somewhat savvy to the system of working with servicers and trying to navigate the modification process. But we didn't have financial assistance that we could offer. We don't have any leverage with the servicers that is different from what a client might have. And we don't have any incentives to try to encourage the servicers to work with a homeowner that they otherwise wouldn't work with. Our counselors, unfortunately, often receive the same runaround that clients receive when they try to call a servicer, and we're really at the mercy of the lending industry to try to work with clients to save their homes. It's heartbreaking for us. NEDCO is in the business of building strong neighborhoods and strong communities, and we know that every foreclosure costs not just a family their home. It also costs them their community, their neighborhood, their schools, the investment that they've made in that house and that neighborhood. It costs the neighborhood an invested and caring homeowner, and it costs the community tens of thousands of dollars. And yet, we were struggling without any sort of concrete or tangible tools. That changed when Oregon received the hardest hit funds and when OHSI created the Mortgage Payment Assistance Program. You've heard a little bit about the basics of that program, but what it means in our world is that homeowners now have a lifeline of generally 12 months, maybe a little less than that. But more importantly than that 1 year of assistance, it buys them the time and the resources to try to make a planful, long-term plan for their family, and to do that in a logical way and in a way that's going to make sense. We can help them during that time evaluate their real financial position, and we can help them plan for how to change that financial position. So even if they are not able to reemploy during the course of the year, perhaps they can pay off consumer debt or otherwise change their financial picture so that a homeowner who is not a good candidate for a modification at the beginning of their year on MPA ends up being a model candidate for a modification by the time they're done with that program. And here, I think, is the somewhat less obvious benefit of MPA, which is that OHSI made a very specific decision to partner with local housing counseling agencies to administer this program. They didn't have to, and as most of us probably know, collaboration isn't always the easiest route to a program, but I think it is often the best. And in this case, it has not only ensured that clients who are applying for MPA receive the personal touch of having a local counseling agency and local staff that they can talk to in person, but it has also introduced every client receiving MPA assistance to the education and counseling resources that are available to them in their community through housing counseling agencies. Already, over 20% of NEDCO's MPA clients have accessed services outside of MPA at NEDCO. Those could be a default workshop, it could be our financial recovery classes, or it could be direct individual counseling. And we expect that number to rise significantly as people near their exit from the MPA program. We've staffed up accordingly, and we hope to be able to serve anybody who wants that. OHSI also looked to the partner agencies to collaborate with them on creating the homeowner education program that I believe was a recommendation of the legislature when MPA was first being coordinated. They came to us to utilize our expertise for what topics should be included, how to format those videos and the worksheets so that we could best help homeowners plan for their the financial exit, essentially, and plan to make the most use of their time on MPA. OHSI didn't have to partner with us. They didn't have to work as closely with us as they have throughout the process. They have solicited input from us. They've asked for feedback. And they have made huge changes to their process throughout, including to this upcoming Mortgage Payment Assistance Unemployment Program, as a response to the feedback that we and our clients have given to them. And despite bumps in the road, I think Margaret mentioned some of them. I think you are probably familiar with some of them. It hasn't been an easy process for our agency. But here's the bottom line that I come back to at the end of the day, which is that in 2010, NEDCO was able to serve about 600 clients through our regular foreclosure counseling services. In 2011, we were able to serve 1,200 people with the MPA assistance just in our three counties. And that doesn't include the clients who were receiving our regular services. That's twice the number that we can normally serve, and we finally had concrete financial assistance that we could provide to them. And now in 2012, we're getting ready to launch the MPAU program, and we expect at NEDCO to be able to serve hundreds more in our three counties. Those are homeowners that have been able to keep their homes now. They finally have a fighting chance to keep their homes in the future with all of the ensuing benefits to that family, that community, and that neighborhood. Thank you. And now I would actually like to turn it over to Jeff, who is, like Adam, a client of NEDCO's through the MPA program. They both are in Clackamas County, where we have been serving.
Good morning.
Welcome to the committee.
My name is Jeff Russell, and let me sum it up. This program has saved my home. I would have lost my house. A little background about me. I was a custom home builder, land developer for 15 years, probably employed close to 200 people in various stages of my projects, you know, coming and going, different trades, different vendors, putting the money back in the local economy. And that industry, as you know, is pretty much dried up. You could go buy a house for 50 cents on the dollar opposed to me being able to build it. So that being said, it was time for a career change and trying to regroup, figure out what I'm going to do when I grow up type thing. And it's like, you know, that's all I knew is how to build. And it's kind of scary, you know, trying to figure out what I'm going to do, and just started losing different possessions, just trying to maintain, sold, you know, a couple extra cars I didn't really need, you know, and properties here and there just to try to maintain my existence. And, you know, this program has really helped me to maintain my home. Without it, like I said, my home probably would have already been in foreclosure. So I can't tell you how much this has meant to me. I think it's a good program, and I think it's not really a lifestyle I want to maintain to have assistance all the time. It's just a temporary crutch to get me back to where I need to be able to feel good about being able to pay my bills and productive. And, you know, nobody really expects these things to happen, the economy to come to a standstill, especially in the housing market, how much it just really came to a screeching halt. And it was just time to try to figure it out and do what was best and try to maintain my home and use the program as it was set up. And I feel very, very, very grateful to be part of it. And I think it's a very successful program. So.
Great. Jeff, thank you for coming.
You're very welcome.
Any questions for them? All right. Well, it sounds like you're on the right track, and I think the whole point of the hearing was to make sure that we had the information to take back to our constituents, make sure that all of our constituents are getting a fair shot at this assistance, we know that there were big problems early on, but we want you to do better, and we appreciate you coming. We may, you know, I don't know if in January or February we'll have time to do a hearing, but I certainly would like you to come back perhaps in the interim and tell us how the next phase is proceeding. And we appreciate your work as well as yours. And Jeff, thank you for coming down to tell your story. All right, colleagues, anything else for the good of the order? I also wanted to put on the record, I didn't ask Rose Cox to identify herself. I meant to. She was the one who was testifying on one of the LC, so if it's unclear in the record who was testifying about LC 237, that was Rose Cox. All right, anything else, committee? This meeting is adjourned. Thank you.